For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Lord, thank you very much that we follow you and we can follow you in a lot of different areas of our lives. This particular area is one where I think the church can make a big difference. There's a difference that needs to be made. So we put this time in your hands. I pray that there might be some people here that could take this information back and help a lot of people with what they learn. In your name we pray. Amen. Okay, so here's the issue that we're going to talk about today, and that is what I call end-of-life suffering that's needless. Because in America today, we know how to keep people alive for a long time. In background, I'm a physician and a pastor. For the last 14 years, I've pastored and practiced medicine. My medical practice is in hospital medicine at a hospital here in town, and I work on a teaching service. So these are patients that are sick enough, they have to be hospitalized, and so then we take care of them. And what I see so much of the time are situations where there are people that are really at the end of their life. They've had chronic problems, oftentimes severe dementia. It's not like these problems come out of the blue, but then they get a life-ending or life-threatening condition like pneumonia or overwhelming infection. They get brought to the hospital. No one's ever talked about these issues with them before, and they end up receiving a lot of care. A lot of care that really is futile and very, very expensive. So we're dealing with what I think is a very important social issue. It's a social issue that most people don't understand, most people are unwilling to talk about it, but it's one that really, in organized medicine, we're not doing a very good job, and I am appealing to people in the church to talk about it, because so much of the time, we as friends and family and pastors have access to people that are making these kind of decisions. And if we can be educated as pastors, we can help people make informed decisions. Because the main thread that I want to talk about here today, and you'll see, is that is people need to have the opportunity to make a decision about their future. And we advocate that. There's a patient bill of rights, all these advocacies that people get to make a decision about what they would want in their health, and yet when it comes to these end-of-life decisions, it just doesn't happen in so many cases. And so what do they get? Well, they get a lot and a lot more and more care, and a lot of times the care is not really very helpful. So did everyone get a handout? All right. Well, I just want you to, before I show this video, imagine with me. Imagine that you've lived a good life and you're facing the end. Okay? Good life, you're facing the end. And just imagine where you would be, who would be with you, what kind of measures would you want taken?
Metastatic breast cancer.
Oh, sorry. I wondered where that metastatic breast cancer was coming from. The Dalai Lama, how about that? Okay, we'll just pause this for a second. But just imagine, you've lived a good life, you're facing the end. What would you want? Where would you want to be? What would you want to happen? And you ask people this, and it very rarely includes being in the hospital. It rarely includes being on a ventilator. It rarely includes having life-sustaining measures like CPR. Most people would want to be at home. They would want to be a family. They would want their symptoms and pain under good control. And yet, what we're going to find is that is not what happens. So this is a segment that was done by Religion and Ethics News Weekly. They came here to our hospital and filmed this. And I think it sort of lays the groundwork. So let's just play this.
One big issue is how treatment at the end of life might become more humane and less expensive. Right now, in most states, when a dying patient can no longer communicate, doctors have no choice but to keep care going,
even okay.
If it's painful for the patient, very expensive, and unlikely to do any good. clear legal instructions in advance about what they do and do not want done when they become terminally ill.
She's been fighting cancer for 5 years twice. She has emphysema of the lungs real bad. It's gotten worse, they said, since she's been in here. And right now she's fighting a bad stroke. They're not sure, but they're saying something like it could affect her left side and maybe her brain.
Did she need any instructions about what to do? No, she did not.
And that's a major problem, says Dr. Jeff Gordon, an internist at Grant Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Gordon has had dying patients who have not made their wishes known and haven't realized that some extreme measures are almost always futile.
Most people think that is for elderly people especially, that heroic measures like CPR and ventilator support is really effective. And the truth is, in older people with complicated medical problems, it just doesn't work effectively. So the bottom line is people suffer needlessly at the end of life. Ventilator, there's a plastic tube that goes through the mouth into the windpipe. And just imagine the gagging kind of feeling. Now, we give high levels of sedation to inhibit that, but that alone. Now, think of yourself, these people are typically there, have to be restrained so that they don't just reflexly reach up and pull that tube out. And so they have their arms restrained, they can't move freely. And think of yourself being on your back restrained, just the muscle aches and pains that you would develop.
Dr. Gordon points out that sometimes aggressive treatment is a good idea.
Intensive care and heroic measures are awesome when they're used in the right people. The right people typically are younger people that have a chance of survival and having a good outcome.
Dr. Philip Hawley, who is director of the intensive care unit, says the state mandate is to keep life going, no matter the cost. So, although doctors think their patients should be allowed to die peacefully, their hands are tied by custom and law.
We have people who are terminal on aggressive life support measures. Clearly, they're not going to survive. We're spending all this time and money taking care of them. They are suffering, and it's completely inappropriate.
What people need to do is talk about this with their family, with their physician, in advance. If they get a life-threatening illness, a lot of times they won't be able to. Maybe they won't be coherent, or they'll be on a life support machine. They can't express their wishes. Then they put their family in a bind. So they feel guilty. They don't know for sure. And then what often happens is the sort of default is, well, let's do everything as much as possible.
And sometimes families disagree about what to do. It's hard for some to let go, which complicates things further.
If we could get families to deal with this, we would not have this problem. We feel that we as physicians should be able to step in and say, we got to stop the madness.
Lord, help us have that perspective. That's what changes lives. That's what gives us hope.
Dr. Gordon, who is also a non-denominational pastor, was surprised to find that patients who are religious often want more aggressive treatment at the end of life than others.
I've even encountered people that are people of faith, and they are, what I think, pursuing futile type measures, and they say, well, we're going to let God have his way here. And I try to, as gently as possible, say, you know, we're not really letting God have his way, we are forcing the issue here.
Has anyone ever talked to you about this?
Oh, no.
No. No. It's a topic that doesn't get talked about.
Dr. Gordon practices what he preaches by getting patients, as well as their families, to talk about what they want at the end of life while they still can.
Yeah.
And he tries to make both patients and families aware of realistic rates of recovery.
I just want you to understand is that those kind of things like CPR and breathing machines in somebody that's got the problems that you have are not very effective. You need to decide whether that's something you would want or not, but you need to have all the facts about it, too.
One of the reasons conversations like this rarely happen between patients and physicians, says Dr. Gordon, is that physicians are paid to treat, not to talk, which is not to say that some don't talk anyway.
The person that needs to have this conversation is a primary care physician. They're going to have to call family members. They're going to have to gather these people. And besides that, it's a very difficult conversation. And so we're underpaying them. They're going to have to make a financial sacrifice to have this discussion. And then we wonder why something happens.
There are three things people can do to make their end-of-life wishes clear. Sign a durable power of attorney, naming a person to make decisions if they are unable. Sign a living will, which is about long-term life-sustaining treatments, and deal with the DNR question, whether if your heart stops, you want to be resuscitated or not.
All right, we'll stop there.
Metastatic breast cancer.
All right, well, I think they did a pretty good job presenting the issues, and the people that you saw in there, the elderly people that I was talking to, none of those people had had a discussion about these issues. And all of them could have died during that hospitalization. And that's the pitiful thing. That's the pitiful reality of healthcare in America today. And I think you'll see from some of the other things that I'm going to share with you that what we're looking at is not a good situation. So I told you about the... we had you imagine, and here's what patients with a serious illness, interesting. I have one thing on my screen and it has another one on that screen. That's fascinating. Where is it getting that? Okay, now let's try it again. Okay. Hocus pocus. It worked. Okay. I don't know how that happened, folks, but it's working. Here's what patients with a serious illness want. They would like control of their pain and their symptoms. That's like shortness of breath. That's a terrible thing, that feeling that you're being smothered. They want to avoid inappropriate prolongation of the dying process. They want to have a sense of control. They would like to relieve the burden on their family. That's why so many people say, you know, if I had a case where I had bad dementia and I was a burden on my family, I would rather die. And just let me die. What I'm not advocating here is speeding the death by intervention, what we might call euthanasia or mercy killing, physician assisted suicide. I'm not advocating that. What I'm advocating is let people make an informed decision. Okay? They'd like to strengthen the relationships. Where does that happen best? At home, where the family can be involved. This is from an article published in Journal of American Medical Association. Here's what patients get. Half of people that died in this study, these were elderly people, had severe pain. They didn't get the top priority was pain control and symptom relief. 38% died spending 10 or more days in an ICU, intensive care unit. On a ventilator. You know how much an ICU costs a day? Just think in your mind. $15,000 to $25,000. Okay? A day. A day. So 10 days, that's $250,000 maybe. And it's worse than waste because you are prolonging the suffering of a person that might have given the opportunity to deny that care would have said, I don't want it. Okay? That's the problem. Right there. All right, this was from another JAMA article. So this is the problem. People receive care that they would decline if we would simply give them the opportunity. And this is the result is they suffer needlessly, and it is a tremendous, an unbelievable financial cost. So the way I like to talk about this whole issue is in terms of informed consent, okay? Informed consent. If you have a surgery, your physician is expected to provide informed consent, which means they are expected to give you a discussion about the benefits of the surgery, the risks of the surgery, and the alternatives to the surgery. That's informed. That means you went into it with both eyes open, and you sign a form that says your physician did that. And you know what? If you had a complication and you did not have informed consent, I could be your malpractice attorney, okay? Because it's an open and closed case. This is such a high ethical value in medicine that patients have the right to know the risks, the benefits, and the alternatives before they would agree to any surgery. It's malpractice if you don't provide that for a surgery. But you can come into the hospital and no one can say word one to you except, do you have a living will? Do you have a durable power of attorney? And you say no to those. There's no follow-up questions. And you could get CPR, you could put on a ventilator and sent off to a long care acute care hospital for weeks on a ventilator, and you would never made the decision. You'd have no legal recourse. Okay? If say your children or somebody said, no, we want to keep Dad alive as long as he wanted. Even if you didn't want that, if you didn't make those wishes, no, you get it. It's yours. And nobody even squawks about this. That's got me pulling my short hair out, because nobody's talking about this. You know, last summer when they talked about the health care reform and the whole thing about the death panels, you know what that was? Nobody had read the legislation. I did. I read those pages. It was to pay physicians to have an end-of-life discussion, an optional discussion with their patients. That's what it was for. And it became a death panel. Okay? So that's how these things get politicized. It shows how afraid our culture is to talk about death. You know, last study I read on this, big study, every human dies. We don't need to study that, right? Everybody's going to face this. If there's 100% mortality, Lazarus, Jesus raised him from the dead. He died, you know, later. Okay? Jesus was resurrected, you know, and I guess Enoch, God took him and he took Elijah. But the rest of us are stuck having to die until the Lord returns. So what I think that we're denying people is this right. And that's why it's wrong. It's a moral issue. And it needs to be discussed. The thing that makes this even worse is to understand how misinformed people are about this issue. And I'm going to give you a few things that illustrate that. That people just don't know the facts. Okay, if a person goes into the hospital, they're over 70, they have a medical issue that's got them in there, like they have pneumonia. They're over age 70. So in today's world, that's not that old, really. But still, over age 70, you're in the hospital and your heart stops. What chance would you say that person would have of being resuscitated, brought back to life, and walk out of the hospital? Over 70 with a medical problem, their heart stops, they get resuscitated, and maybe they don't walk out, they just get discharged, they get wheeled out in a wheelchair. So just think in your mind. I won't have you raise your head, your hand, but would you think it's in like the 75% range, the 50%, the 40, the 30, the 20, the 10, around there? Well, here's what most people think. In this study, 83% of people thought they had a 50% or greater chance of survival to discharge. Survival to discharge. Okay, well, here's the way this breaks down. And there are a lot of studies. In the book I wrote, there's an appendix that deals with this. About 20 to 30% survive the initial resuscitation. That is, they get what we call return to spontaneous circulation. The code team comes in and they, you know, we do this. I've been through many of these. You pump on the chest, you put them on, you breathe for them, you give them drugs, 20 to 30%. Okay? You think, well, that's pretty good. 20 to 30% survival. This is not to discharge. This is survival. So now you know where this person goes? ICU. Intensive care unit, and they're on a breathing machine. Well, of this then, survival to discharge is only 5 to 10. One study was zero, okay? 5 to 10% total survival to discharge. Now, this is not the end of the story, because what we found, people that survived a discharge, 40% have a significant neurological injury. They have a stroke. So you've taken that 5 to 10%, you cut it almost in half. So when you look at people that are have a stroke-free survival, it's less than 5%, approaching zero. If you take this out to a six-month survival, it's practically zero. You think, why is that? When your heart stops and you're this age and you got a complicating medical factor, somebody's trying to tell you something, okay? It's the end. It's the end. And there's not much that we can do to stand in the way of it. As hard as we try and as much as we spend. And the thing that is really bothersome about this to me is that 20 to 30% survival of the resuscitation. So that means how many of that 30 are going to make it to here? Not very many. And that means they're all going to be on a ventilator. They're going to be for who knows how long, and they're going to suffer. They're going to suffer. These resuscitations, it's not a sterile sort of thing like it looks like, you know, in the movies. It's rough, and it's rough on people. You know, they went back and they asked those people. They asked the population. You think, because here we are, we're thinking we got a 50-50 chance of making it. Well, where do you get your information about health? And where do you think? TV, right? So they went back and they looked at TV reality shows in that era. 67% survival of resuscitation. So see, the failure really doesn't make very good TV drama, does it? I mean, you got to save somebody to get your ratings up. Nielsen ratings just don't go with failure. I mean, if you only save 5% and a bunch of those people have strokes, it's going to look like medicine doesn't work. That just doesn't sell. But it's false. It's false. In fact, the name of the article is New England Journal of Medicine, which is one of the most prestigious medical journals, was Miracles and Misinformation. Was the title of the article, and it's in your notes here, I think. Well, this is rough. This is really rough stuff. And that's what people thought. Well, I call this the information gap. And if we want people to make an informed decision, they need to know this. They need to know this. So that's what I try to sit down with patients and try to help them understand what the truth is. And you know what? It does take time. It takes a lot of effort. And the one point that I made briefly in that film, or in that story, was that the person that usually does this is a primary care physician. And what most people don't understand is that doctors get paid in this economy more to do things like procedures than they do to get talk to patients. That's why primary care doctors are really declining. That's why more and more doctors coming out of medical school are not going into primary care specialties. They have all these loans that they have to pay off, average over $140,000. The salaries are the lowest in family medicine, pediatrics, general internal medicine. They're the bottom of the scale. And that's some of the hardest work to do. One of my friends, okay, this guy was one of the best guys in our class. He was an internist. He's a great internist. He went into practice in Bellevue, Ohio, up by Lake Erie, had a good practice going. He did hospital medicine and office medicine. So good, he kept his patients. Okay? So last year, because he had 73% of his practice was Medicare, they went broke and closed their doors. So in every other profession, when you're in your, I'm 52, okay? He's 50. Peak earning years, it should, especially for a professional. This guy is as sharp as he could be. He was a pharmacist. He went to medical school. But because he was a good physician, because he kept his patients, they were paid to him by the government, underpaid to him. He went broke. You know how much Medicare pays for 1 hour? $112. You think, that's a lot. You just walked through the parking lot that they paved, the rent they paid, the malpractice they paid, the front desk person they paid, the nurse they paid, the medical assistant they paid, $112. You think they're making anything? It's probably costing them. That's why they have to limit the number. So you think they're going to take an hour to do this? And then every son and daughter is going to want them to talk to them on the phone? You know how much doctors get reimbursed for non-face-to-face time? Just like an attorney, $200 an hour. No. Zero. Zero. They pick up the, you expect them to call you back, don't you? You know how much they can charge for that to the insurance company? Nothing. Zero. That's why nobody wants to do primary care. They go broke. Okay? So, I mean, for those of you that talk to senators and legislators and that kind of thing, you know, now with the health care legislation, there's going to be more of a demand for primary care doctors, right? Yeah, because everybody's going to have access now. And so what's going to happen to this issue? Is it going to get better or worse?
It'll get worse.
It's going to get worse because their time is going to be more stretched. So anyway, I'm just telling you folks, this is one of these kind of issues that's hidden back there. You know, you just tell by the attendance that people, you know, people just, they don't understand and they don't know. But this is really going to be bad. And listen, it's getting worse because the segment of the population that's in this group is growing. You know, a lot of the baby boomers are coming into this. So over the next 20 years, there's this tsunami of spending. And every year there's more medical devices, there are more medical procedures, you know, there's surgeries that you can perform. You know, you see people that are bedridden getting like total hips and knees and stuff like that. You're like, what is going on? It's crazy. It's crazy. So there's another, you can see this bugs the heck out of me. You know, the other thing that really bugs me about it is that, I mean, these people are suffering. But I work in an urban hospital, okay? And there are a lot of uninsured people that I take care of. About 30% of the people I take care of are uninsured. And it's the whole gamut, okay? From people that just abuse the system and they're seeking pain meds to homeless people, you know, suicide attempts, drug addicts, prostitutes. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are working poor that would like to have medical care, that have simple problems, you know, like diabetes or hypertension, that could be cared for and kept out of the hospital with real simple measures. $15,000 a day to take care of someone that wouldn't want it. You give me $15,000 to take in the community and take care of people with diabetes, and I can save you a lot of money, okay? But you see, there's not enough foresight to capture this kind of a perspective. And I think it's a lot because it's politicized then. But I think that's why we need kind of a groundswell of understanding, and I think that's why working through churches and pastors is probably better. Here's another telltale reality of American healthcare. Okay, here's the situation. If you had advanced dementia, you lived in a nursing home, and you developed pneumonia. Now, when I say advanced dementia, and from this study, it was the sixth level, which means there's, you know, no memory, no short-term memories. You're in bed. You're incontinent, most likely, and you need help bathing. I mean, eating. Put yourself in that situation. You're living in a nursing home. Now, you develop pneumonia, which could be potentially life-ending, or a urinary tract infection. Pneumonia, is, I put that because so many times these people, they aspirate. They can't swallow right. Food or even saliva gets in the lung, they develop pneumonia. It's common, okay? What would you want? I have two choices for you. The first is take me to the hospital, treat me, and then bring me back to the nursing home. Or the other choice, just two choices in this, don't hospitalize me, keep me comfortable, and let me die naturally if it's my time. You know, maybe you could treat me. Some people say, give me antibiotics and see if I get, some people say, just don't do anything. Just keep me comfortable and let me go. Which one would, who would choose choice number one? Who would choose choice number two? Now, if you went out today and you surveyed Americans of all ages and you gave them this choice, what percent do you think would choose choice number two? I'd say a lot, probably 90%. The people I surveyed, most people, you know why? Because severe dementia, who wants to live like that? Who wants to be a burden on their family? You know how much a nursing home is a month? $3,000 to $5,000. Who's paying for that? Well, they're most people that comes out of their estate until they lose it all, and then who's, you know, who starts paying then? It's Medicaid. So we do. And you know, I don't mind paying for nursing homes, but listen, if these people are in this condition and wouldn't want to be, here's the reality. In America, this is a 2007 study. This was published in the Journal of Geriatrics by a Harvard professor. This is refereed. Gerontologists across the country were part of this. 7.1% of nursing home patients with advanced dementia have do not hospitalize orders. Okay? Do I need to make any more of a case here that this whole thing is totally broken? This is not what people would want. I think it would be the opposite. I think 93% would want to be not hospitalized and 7% might want it. With some hope, I can't even understand it, why you'd want it. I guess if you had a philosophy that, you know, you should take every beat is life. But and I say, if you want that, fine. But what I feel like is that people need to know that they have the choice. And you think, well, why did the nursing home transfer them? Because of this. In a nursing home, they are not permitted to treat acute illnesses unless the patient and their family have agreed to that in advance. Why? Because they're afraid there's an ambulance chase and attorney around the corner that's going to sue them. Okay? You treated that person's pneumonia in here, we'll sue you. And so they have to go through this, getting a physician's order and an agreement from the patient and the family not to hospitalize. And a lot of people don't know they have this choice. And I think that's really complicated. And I think there are a lot of people in the nursing home business that are really into taking care of the patients in their best interest. But there's also the reality that there's a profit to be made, and a nursing home is like a hotel. And how do you make money in a hotel? You fill the room, right? So there's no financial incentive to act in this patient's best interest. See, in our culture, the best interest is to do as much as possible, we think. More is better. But a lot of times, more is not better. It's worse for the patient, and it's worse for society. It is. But you know what? I'm not giving up. We've had times before when people have been misinformed. Look at this. This is a cigarette ad from the 1940s. More doctors smoke camels. We've overcome that misinformation. How about this? Eat, 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 and always stay thin. Fat banished. It says the enemy. How? Sanitized tapeworms. It says, what's it say here? It says, I think it says jarred. Yeah, jar packed. Down here it says easy to swallow. Here, you got to see this. See there? It says no diet. I can't. I think this says baths. No baths. They must have had some steam baths or something. No exercise. That's just like ads today, isn't it? Okay. Sanitized, jar packed. I can't. Easy to swallow. And see, here she is. She's got all of her food that she can eat, and she's thin as can be because she's eating tapeworms. So I guess we can overcome misinformation is what we've found. But it takes, it takes public health effort. I was in Haiti just a couple weeks ago down there with a medical team. People in Haiti, many people don't know that mosquitoes cause malaria. I met these kids. They're smart. These people have intellect. They can learn. No one's teaching them. They don't teach them that, you know, that water laying around in the garbage, if you just knock that away, you get rid of the mosquito larvae, and you, we treated cases of malaria down there in Port-au-Prince. Okay? So it's a public health sort of concern. It's an educational concern. So I think that there are things that can be done to overcome this, and I think we need to pose it in these terms of informed consent, and people need to understand what their alternatives are. What are some alternatives that we have in the face of a serious illness? And one is what we call palliative care or palliative medicine. This is care that is targeted toward symptom relief. Care that's targeted towards symptom relief. So if someone has emphysema, chronic bronchitis, and they feel breathless, then we want to control those symptoms. If they have chronic pain, so many people, back, knee, all kinds of arthritic sort of pain, we want to control the symptoms. That's palliative care. And palliative care at the end of life then is often associated with what's called hospice. And hospice is a philosophy of care, and it's palliative care that is formally administered if somebody has less than 6 months to live. So if we're in a terminal condition and two physicians agree that there's less than 6 months to live, then the patient is a candidate for hospice care. And the important thing about that is then that the hospice is, it's paid for differently. It's actually much better for the patient, because when their hospice is kind of a managed care sort of situation, so that they pay for their medicines, their home care, all these kind of things are paid for under hospice. There's for-profit hospitals, there's non-profit. There's for-profit hospices and there's non-profit hospices. The non-profit hospices here in town, for example, the ones that we work with, it's called Home Reach Hospice through Ohio Health. They raise money because they spend more on the patient care than they get reimbursed, because they have like massage therapists, they have chaplains. It's very holistic, and not only do they take care of the patient, they take care of the family. They have grief support for the family that lasts, you know, well, at least a year, if the family needs it, or more. So it's really targeted to help people die well. There are people that have really good deaths, and there are really bad deaths. And I think that's what we want to avoid, is the bad deaths. So I can answer questions about these two as we go on. But what I want you to think about is this whole issue of advance directives, because this is where you can be helpful to your family, your friends, people in your church. This is where we state in advance what we would want at the end. Some people have thought this through very carefully, like this guy. It says his last request was that we close the casket before you begin. So this fellow had thought his end of life wishes out well, and he hated the bagpipes. But the ones we want to talk about here is, first of all, what we call a living will. And the living will varies from state to state. So are any of you here from outside of Columbus? So you'll have to check and see exactly. What state are you from?
Michigan.
I'm not exactly sure on what the laws are in Michigan. But in Ohio, our living will, it's in effect in two conditions. One is that if you have a terminal condition, two, if you are in a permanently unconscious state. If those two things come into place, then the provisions that you stipulate in your living will, so if you say, I don't want CPR, I don't want life-sustaining measures, I don't want tube feedings, these kind of things, then the living will works. But if you're not in that kind of a situation, that is a terminally unconscious state or a declared terminal illness, then the living will does not work. I still think it's good to have. The healthcare power of attorney, this document allows you to specify someone to make decisions for you if you can't. There was a study just within the last 6 months that showed that over I think it was 60-some percent of people, elderly people, that came into the hospital with an illness did not have decision-making capacity. Not that they didn't before, but because of their illness, they did not have decision-making capacity. So if they didn't have one of these, a living will or a healthcare power of attorney, then who knows what they want? And let me tell you, folks, one of the biggest family disasters that you can come into is this. You got dad here who's in his 80s, he's got a life-ending illness, and this family now is trying to decide what would he want. And you say, well, did you ever talk to him about it? Well, no, we never talked to him. And now it comes down to what they think and how many times you think they agree. And then we have the guilty child complex, the one that never was around. They fly in from Anchorage, okay? And then they're like, they want to be dad's hero. Do everything to keep him alive, okay? They think they're being his advocate. They're going to get a few more beats out of his poor heart, okay? It happens all the time. And it destroys families. And if they would have just talked about it in advance, they would have gotten their wishes out, made them known to their family, they could have headed all this out. I think it's a service that the parent does to their children to let them know. Now, I've had several people come up to me and they say, my kids won't talk to me about it. I try to bring these things up and they're like, don't talk about that. And there's this other myth, which is that if you talk about it with people, then they're going to get depressed and give up on life. That's been totally debunked. Totally. In fact, it's like the big pink elephant in the middle of the room that everyone knows that you should talk about, but we're just looking around it trying to pretend it's not happening. People do better if you talk about it. Okay, so that's the healthcare power of attorney. And then the other issue, and that is of code status. Code status is what happens to you if your heart stops. Now, this again, I'm talking about especially for elderly people, they need to think about this in view of those statistics that I put up there. And that's what I try to, if you're in the hospital and you're in your 80s and you get pneumonia and your heart stops, there's very little chance that you're going to survive that discharge in any kind of meaningful state. And people need to know that. If they say, well, I want to take my chances, maybe I'll be that 5%. I'm like, okay, but at least you're making an informed decision. But if they don't talk about this in advance, then this is going to happen. If they drop, if they die at home and they haven't thought this through, then the squad's going to show up and they're going to try to resuscitate them. And a lot of times they get them back enough to bring them to the hospital. So the code status form in Ohio is a physician's order. These two things, you can get these online and you can fill them out. You don't even need to be, they don't even need to be notarized. I don't think so in Ohio. But the code status is a physician's order that says do not resuscitate. So it's something that you would have to talk about with a physician. And then in the case of nursing home patients, I think particularly people that would rather allow nature to take its course, or in these cases of severe dementia, that you can specify comfort care only and do not hospitalize. There's a website on here that you can go to and you can get a lot of this information, so you don't need to worry about writing a lot down. But in Ohio, you need these three. I have a living will. I have a health care proxy, power of attorney. The code status issue is, I think, more for the elderly that would not want to be resuscitated. I'm still a full code. Hopefully I would have a good chance of survival if I dropped over. Or if I was in the hospital and my heart stopped or something. It would probably mean like I had an electrolyte imbalance or something like that. Something that I would have a good chance of survival from. So then the nursing home issue. I want to talk just briefly here. And then I think we have till 5. Is that right? So we're going to have time for questions. But I want to just talk just briefly here about the financial cost. This is pretty much the ballpark is about 30% of Medicare is spent in the last year of life. Okay? It probably varies from 20, over the last 10 years, around 26 to 30. This may be on the higher end, but just a round number, 30%. In the last year of life. Okay, 15% on the last 2 months. 15% of Medicare in the last 2 months of life. And you can see why. These procedures, this intensive care, is very, very expensive. But if you think of $2,009 dollars, you have any idea what 15% of Medicare would be? $70 billion. Because Medicare expenditures last year were about $450 billion. So that gets you to $1 trillion in about, what, 15 years? Just with that. This does not include private coinsurance. It does not include Medicaid, which is paying for nursing homes. Okay? Add that in, you're probably up to close to $100 billion. And growing. Okay? So, I don't know. Maybe America thinks we just got to keep selling more treasury bonds to China. It's just like running the credit card, you know? I don't know how we're going to pay for this. But we got our heads sort of stuck pretty far down in the sand on it right now. And every time somebody talks about it, there's all this outrage about pulling the plug on Granny. Remember that Time magazine cover, pulling the plug on Granny? It's really unfortunate that there's so much ignorance and so much will for political power that we're willing to hurt people and waste this much. It's sick, but it's true. I'm not exaggerating anything here, folks. Let me tell you, I'm very careful not to. Maybe my tone is one that seems that way, but what I want you to do is learn the facts, because there has to be some people out here that can tell other people. And talk about this with your family. Talk about it with your physician. And for the older people, I say, do it while you can. Well, so you can make the decision, so you can tell people what you want, and then encourage others to do the same when you're out and you're talking about things. Say, have you ever thought about this? You know, it's something that you need to talk about. And so I wrote this book. It's called A Death Prolonged. And what my effort here is to bring people into the setting that I see every day. And so it's written as a story. It sort of dramatizes real life experiences through a short novel. It's only like 150 pages long, but it has an appendix that goes through the facts. It's a book that people have used for book clubs, and it's been written about some, but it's the kind of thing, it's just really hard to get a whole lot of traction in people talking about this. So that's what we're trying to do about this issue. We feel like it's a really important social issue of our time that is relatively unaddressed, and nobody's got too many good ideas about it. So we gotta fight, can't quit. All right, so who has questions or maybe comments or other perspectives? Go ahead.
Sorry, I have a question. On the advance directives, we have mm-hmm. a living will. I was curious to know what is it, like in a living will, do you just say, is it just a matter of just saying you do not want, to prolong your death?
There are different things that you can choose in that I don't want CPR, I wouldn't want any other medical measures. And you can also stipulate whether you would want a feeding tube, because that's a big issue of sort of controversy. And I can talk a little bit about that, because that comes up a lot.
And the other question, on this code status, you know, what happens if your heart stops? Do we have any control over code status, or is it just definitely physician decided upon the code status?
No, you have, but you have to designate to your physician, and you would have to say, I do not want that measure. Okay. But there again, I think it's for in cases, I don't want everybody here to run out and go to their physician and say, make me a do not resuscitate. I don't think that'd be appropriate. I think this is in elderly cases where there's a low chance of survival that you would do that. Okay? Although there are some people that say, you know, they just wouldn't want any kind of extraordinary measures. But see, I see it work too, and I'm a real advocate for it. One time, this was just last April, I was riding my bike on the bike path, and I come up, and there's a guy down. He was dead. Cardiac arrest on his bike. And we did CPR on him. The squad got there. They defibrillated him. They put pads on him. And he survived it. He didn't have a stroke. He didn't even have a heart attack. And he's a veterinarian. He works for the University of Cincinnati. And I've gotten to be friends with him. So, I mean, it does work. But like ventricular fibrillation, the survival rate is around 30%. See? So,
he wasn't 70 years old either.
No, he was like 58.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Do
yes.
You bike with him now?
No, I haven't.
I have a question on, let's say you're an 80-year-old person.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent health.
Mm-hmm.
No diabetes, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into the hospital and they... When will you at what age do you recommend them not doing
the CPR?
Yeah.
You know, it would depend on, like if an 80-year-old person came in and they were in otherwise good health and they'd had a heart attack, they're having a heart attack. Well, when you're having a heart attack, the most common way you can die suddenly is this ventricular fibrillation, okay? Ventricular fibrillation is the easiest thing to save somebody from. So I've had patients that have come in, they've had do not resuscitate. They're having a heart attack. And I said, you know what I would recommend is that you reverse that for now. Let's go full code. And if you're on a ventilator, we could stop it. But there's a good chance that we just put the paddles on, pow, and you're out of it. We should do that. So it would really depend. And I think it needs to be sort of talked about and customized.
You get to a certain age, you have to be careful because you break the ribs and puncture the lung.
Yeah.
The older you get, the more fragile the bone.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's where
I
would go with that.
I think that, again, it needs to be discussed. I think at 80, say if they came in at 80 years old and they had a pneumonia or they had a stroke, and they'd had really good health up until that time, but they come in with a stroke and they can't move one side of their body, I would recommend do not resuscitate. We'll do everything to get them better, but if your heart, you know, if you've had a stroke and you're 80 years old and now your heart stops, listen, it's over. We might make you linger for a long time, but there's not going to be a substantial quality of life. So even though, And that's what a lot of times they're like, gosh, they were doing really good up till now, but it's like, but there's that big but. Up till now, they've got something now, and so we've got to talk about it and sort of know the lay of the land. But in most cases, I'd probably recommend in an 80-year-old that you'd say, well, let's treat your illness, but if your heart stops, I think a good way to say it is say, if your heart stops, we let it stop. If your heart stops, we let it. There's a play written, can't remember the author, it's called Wit, W-I-T, and it was made into a movie. I never saw the movie, Emma Thompson was in it. I just saw clips from it, but I read the play. It's excellent, and that was the line they used in there. They said, if your heart stops, do you want us to just let it stop? Okay? Do you have a question, Joe?
It seems like a lot of the negative publicity kind of puts things towards like the Kevorkian, or you're trying to do mercy killings and things like that. Are there ever situations where the patient says, you know, what do you recommend?
Mm-hmm.
And where people would be uncomfortable with the idea of like, oh, the doctor's going to try to persuade them towards mm-hmm. death or something like that?
Well, there are different views there. I mean, there are some people that, this term paternalism, and paternalism means that someone in authority is trying to boss somebody around, basically is the most negative spin on paternalism. But, you know, on the other side of saying, well, that it's paternalistic to give advice. Well, you know, if I take my car to the mechanic, who I trust, and he says, listen, this thing is shot and it needs a $500 repair, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to, I guess I could take it to another mechanic, or I could somehow try to figure it out myself, or I could rely on his expertise. He knows so much more about this. How can I ever get up to speed with that? And that's the way I look at these kind of situations too. It's like, man, I've seen this for, I've been a doctor since what, 85, you know? That's a long time. And I've seen a lot of these cases. This is your first one. This is your first one in a series of one, okay? I've got a series of hundreds or thousands that I've seen, and I can tell you, I can give you my, do you want that or not? You know, and I think a lot of it is, and here's another big problem, okay? Today, when you come to the hospital, your doctor that you had for years, a lot of times you don't have a doctor for years because the insurance companies have undermined all that. Because they don't take this doctor on the panel, so you got to switch to another doctor. So there's not this, there's not rapport and trust. Now you come into the hospital and you know who takes care of you? A hospitalist. That's what I am. I'm a hospitalist. So I've never seen most of these patients before. Because you know why physicians had to do that? Because they couldn't afford to come to the hospital because they're going to get $50 and they get one or two patients, so they get $100. They've driven to the hospital, they've parked, they've come in, they've seen the patients, they've written the orders, they talk to them and everything, then they go to their office. Who can afford to do that? So you're going to let a hospitalist take care of them where that's all they do. It's just an economic reality of the way the system. Listen, if you've got a factory that's making cars and they've got a door that's not working right, the factory is designed exactly to produce it. There's a problem. We are getting exactly what our system is designed to produce. And that is pitiful treatment on this end of things when it comes to talking about issues and having trust. Because that's what this comes down to, you know, in a difficult conversation. I got to go from 0 to 60 where this person doesn't know me from Adam to I'm going to trust you with the life of my loved one. That's really difficult. Yeah, John, and then you'll be next.
Sorry, you mentioned the expectation gap between 50% and 5%. Is that a source of then malpractice accusations or action because of that expectation gap?
I think that it is. I think there is a very high expectation in the American public that we can fix a lot of things that we can't. And, you know, we're a very litigious society. My son was in a car accident. He was not at fault. We had our phone lit up the next day with ambulance chasing attorneys calling to with their chiropractors and everything. Okay? Why? Well, they go down and they get the accident report. I mean, you see all the, have you been injured, you know? Did you have a, they're just trolling for business all over, and so, there's all kinds of defensive medicine that's practiced, and part of the reason that a doctor won't talk about this, because you're not going to get sued by doing more. You might get sued if you do less. So why take the risk? And every time you go and renew your medical license or any insurance application, one of the questions that you always gulp on is, are you named in any malpractice actions at this time? You know, who wants to be named? Would you like to be named in a malpractice action? No, so you do everything to protect yourself, and this is one of them. Yeah, go ahead.
You must be a maverick in this. I mean, we have an older congregation, and we have sat by the, you know, the bedside of countless people who, you know, 90-year-olds, and they're, you know, they have a pain, and they're going for catheterization. And the doctors will say, well, that's what we are supposed to do. Now, is it driven by the attorneys? Is it driven by the hospital who requires you to do so many advanced procedures so that you can keep your standing with the hospital? It seems like the patient care is at the bottom of the list.
Well, I mean, and I think it varies from hospital to hospital. I'd recommend there's an article, if you're interested in this, it's called The Cost Conundrum. The Cost Conundrum. The author's name is Gawande. It's spelled G-W-A-N-D-E. Gawande, The Cost Conundrum. And what they did is they looked at Medicare costs per capita. And they looked county by county in the U.S. And looked at ranges. So they looked at the top. The top was like South Beach, Florida, $16,000 per capita. Then there were lower ones. The average was around the $8,000 per capita. The county that Mayo Clinic's in, $8,000 per capita. Then they found this county down in Texas called McAllen, Texas, $16,000 per capita. Up the Rio Grande River, about 50 miles is El Paso, Texas, $8,000 per capita. They're like, we're going to McAllen to see what's going on. And their conclusion was, in McAllen, Texas, they don't have any oil, and they can't grow anything, but they got Medicare. And they are working it. They are working it. And that is what you see in some places, where they've got a potential procedure. And you know where hospitals, you think people just like heart? Why do you think everybody has a heart hospital? Duh. It pays big, it's mucho, you know. They live by the golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules, okay? And the heart hospital makes money. Heart catheterizations, stents, the putting in pacemakers. I had an old attending when I was in training. A little old lady had a pacemaker in that it seemed like she didn't need, and he called the syndrome fainting spell in Florida. So she's down there in Florida and she has a fainting spell and she comes back with a pacemaker. So, you know, I think there are cases where there's too much done and it's driven by greed. I think there are a lot of physicians that don't want to do more and realize that you know, we can't live on a system. We just can't sustain the amount of waste that we have right now.
In the video clip, you mentioned something about people of faith.
Mm-hmm.
What was that again?
Oh, okay. There was an interesting study, and in fact, since that, there's been an article that's sort of overturned that. But there was a study that was published in Journal of American Medical Association, which is a fairly prestigious journal, that showed that people that had, they called it high religious coping. So they were in a faith community, they prayed and this sort of thing. When it came to the end of life, they wanted more interventions. And it was particularly intensive care. And the authors were trying to themselves figure this out. And what was real interesting, I was in Boston in March for the Hospice and Palliative Care National Meetings, and I got to meet the author of that paper. And they've done some other follow-up studies, and so that's not quite as clear, because they're showing that if people get talked to about their religious beliefs and how they fit in with their end-of-life decision-making, that they're actually, in this other study, asking for less care. I guess what surprised me about that is I would think people of faith would say, all right, you know, it's my time to go, you know.
When you said that, that's what I thought. It's like, isn't the reality of their faith, is it really real, or is it just something
yeah.
I held on to for a while, and now the time has come at the end, and well, I'm not sure if I really trust God
yeah.
in my last days.
But we do see a substantial number of people that are more from a, well, I guess mine is only anecdotal. But I do see some that are like, you know, we just put this in God's hands and, you know, we'll just, if he's ready to take her, he'll take her. And I'm like, well, you know, I don't know if we're looking at this the right way. But I do see that. But I still talk to them. Other questions? Yes.
This healthcare power of attorney, can that be any person, even not a relative?
Yes.
And if that person declaring that power of attorney, can they override, say, close relative if they wind up being a death?
Yep. Yep. And that's why you would designate. And what I would recommend, and you can have a first and a second choice too. So if the first choice is not available, the second choice can make the decision. And I always recommend that the person who declares a healthcare power of attorney, that they tell their family who that is. And I also tell them, you need to talk to your family about what you want, because you don't want to put your healthcare power of attorney in a position where they're having to fight against these guys. You're going to mess up your family. Don't leave that as your legacy. So that's what I try to encourage them to do. This stuff gets so messy. You can see why nobody wants to do it, you know? Yes?
The living will would protect us if we're terminally ill or permanently unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Dementia.
Mm-hmm.
I want to protect myself if I have dementia. Is there anything you suggest, writing things so there's an understanding, or do just talk to your power of attorney and hope they...
You'd have to talk to your power of attorney, and I think talk to your physician. Mm-hmm. And in Ohio, there's a movement that's, I hate to even say it's afoot, because it's staggering, but there's another paradigm. It's called POLST, Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. In Ohio, it'll probably be called Medical Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, because nurse practitioners will be able to write these orders too. But it's so much simpler than our current language. It's simpler for the physicians, it's simpler for the patients, and it's more custom made that I would want this, I wouldn't want that. There's also, in your state or in your relative state, there's a document, it's recognized in 40 states, it's called Five Wishes. Five Wishes. And it's something it's a proprietary piece. In other words, you have to pay for each one, and they're like $5 a piece. But it's very customized, and it's excellent. If you have that in Michigan, that's what you do. You Five Wishes. Well, they tried to get it in Ohio, and Ohio, we're like in the back 40 on this. Let me tell you, I don't know why.
How do you get it? The Five Wishes.
You just order it online, or somebody might have it.
You can type in on Google Five.
Yeah, just it's called. Go to my website that's on here, and I've got a link to Five Wishes.
Many of our hospice organizations provide them to us.
You don't need a living will. You don't need a health care power of attorney. You don't need code status. It's all in Five Wishes.
But not in Ohio.
Not in Ohio.
But we can get it, though, in Ohio.
You can get it, but it wouldn't be legally binding.
Oh, so for us in Ohio, we have to get the power of attorney.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they'll probably change it to these medical orders for life. Let me just, are other questions?
I just wanted to say one thing about the, if you have a living will and you stipulate what you want, and then you have somebody as your medical power of attorney, that medical power of attorney can override your living will in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just basically described my mother in the hospital.
Mm.
She had a TIA, a mini stroke that gave her short-term memory issues. And my mother knew it. And we made all these arrangements ahead of time. We had the living will, medical power of attorney, funeral arrangements, everything is done. I kept my mother independent as long as I could. When I had to put her in a nursing home, that was fine. Then she got progressively worse with the dementia, like you said, mm-hmm. just like here. And I have a Christian doctor, thank goodness, primary care physician. And I discussed with him the feeding tube issue. And I also discussed it with another physician when mother was 90. And did not do it. And I thought mother was going to go home at that point. So I'm in a lot of organic and naturopathic healing. Mother was not eating. I brought mother back with my concoction of stuff by spending hours having her drink 12 ounces of this, and I brought her back within 2 weeks, and they said, you know, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. They got her back in physical therapy, and mother's up and about, and everything is fine. I didn't do the feeding tube, but then the dementia got worse, and this is what I'm saying. It's really tough, because mother says, you can't make me eat, and that's not my mother there talking. So now I had to make the decision, are we going to do a feeding tube now? This is a mental state with mother, not a physical state. So I decided to go with the feeding tube. And if the Lord wills it, mother will be 96 in August. She does have the dementia, but she knows me, and we have, you know, this conversation and this rapport. And you are correct about hospice. When mother developed pneumonia, about 2 months ago, severely. And I thought, this is it. And hospice said, what do you want to do? Do you want to send her to the hospital? Or do you want to just take her off all of her meds, treat it with antibiotics, and see what happens?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that this is it. We'll pull all meds. Go ahead and give her the antibiotics. That won't hurt anything. Mm-hmm. It's going to help with the bacteria or whatever. And I thought, this is it. My mother's strong. She, you know, and I go visit mm-hmm. her now, and she's fine, and she'll talk to me. She has good days. She has bad days. So it's a very fine area. Mm-hmm. It's a great area mm-hmm. of what to do.
Mm-hmm. It's real difficult. I think the feeding tube, you had a pretty good result that's really unusual. Because with the feeding tube in people with dementia, they've done studies where they've compared, it's called compassionate feeding, where you let the person eat as much as they'll want versus a feeding tube, and they've shown no survival benefit from the feeding tube. But 71% of people with a feeding tube have to be restrained.
Okay.
So they don't pull them out.
My mother's not restrained.
Yeah.
Actually, you said 6 months on hospice. My mother's been on hospice now 15 months.
Mm-hmm.
And
she might get discharged from hospice.
I know, which is 15 months now.
People do get discharged. We should let a couple ask questions. But that's very fascinating. Thanks for sharing that. Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, you started to say the name of medical, and that name, which you're hoping that we could get, which makes it simple, medical.
Oh, POLST, all caps, is, and you can search for that, and you can get an example. And the five wishes, did you write that down?
Yes, but you also called it medical.
Mm-hmm. Medical orders, MOLST, medical orders for life-sustaining treatment, MOLST. Okay. Yes.
This is a whole nother session, and we have minutes left, but I was just curious about your thoughts about verses that you carry with you in your medical profession and caring for people in these wonderful end-of-life care decision helps that you give people. The great physician feeds us all, and I'm just
Well, I think I try to help people, and you know, it really depends if they want my input, because here again, I'm in this situation where they don't know me, and it's not like I have rapport. Frankly, it's uncommon that I get into spiritual conversations with families at the end. So, oh yeah, we have a ministry in this church called Final Hope, where they help. And then I have friends that are chaplains in hospices too, and I think it's a great way to serve. It's a great ministry. But I think for pastors, I just wish people would talk about this more, because it's an issue that medicine's not doing it. It's, you know, when there have been big social issues before, the church has been one of the main movers and shakers. When you looked at abolition, you look at the civil rights movement, it was the church that led the way. And I think this is one of the areas where we just shouldn't let people suffer like this, and we shouldn't let the people suffer that could be using the funds that we're really not using appropriately. So thanks for coming.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.